This is a Prism Webcast News production. In this first of a new series of interviews for Prism Webcast News, I speak to Russell Norman, co-leader of the Green Party in New Zealand, and I start off by asking, Russell, how on earth did you end up in New Zealand politics?
I ended up in New Zealand because I was doing a PhD looking at the New Zealand Alliance. My PhD was based out of Macquarie University in Sydney, and I came over to New Zealand to live over here while I researched. And, yeah, I loved the place, and one thing led to another, and I never left.
So what made you, I suppose you're in the Alliance, so what made you choose the Greens? Did you, I suppose you went with the Greens when they split from the Alliance?
I was in the Greens in Australia, and I was involved in setting up the Green Party in South Australia in 95, and I joined the Greens when I got here, and then when the Greens left, I left with the Greens. I just stayed in the Greens, and we left.
How on earth did you end up being the co-leader of the Green Party then?
Well, I decided that I wanted to do something practical in politics after I finished my PhD. So I went and got a job working as an out-of-parliament secretary for the Greens in Auckland, and I was deeply involved in organising the G3 campaign up there, and I was the coordinator of a big rally we held up there in 2001. And then a job came up in Wellington working as Sue Bradford's executive assistant, so that looked interesting, so I thought I'd do that through to the election in 2002. And then after the election I was going to move on, but there were some jobs in the research group or the advisory group in Parliament, so I applied for one of those, and I got one of those jobs. And that was a great job, actually. That's probably the best job I've had. And then when they were looking for a campaign manager in 2004, and they'd done a first round of applications and hadn't found anyone that they particularly thought was suitable, so they started shoulder-tapping people, and they shoulder-tapped me to be campaign manager, which I did with a little bit of reluctance, but I kind of realised it had to be done. So then I did that for 2005 election, and then I went and got a job elsewhere, and then, of course, Rod died. And after Rod died, we had to find someone to be the male co-leader, because we have male and female co-leaders. And I kind of looked around and figured I was probably the best person for the job. So put my hat in the ring, and here I am.
What drives you as a politician? And say if we, when you leave politics in 10, 20 years' time, whether it's voluntary or by the voter, what would you like to look back and see that you've achieved?
I'd like to think that I was part of a change in mindset in society in New Zealand and in the world, whereby we came to accept that the planet is finite and that resources are finite, and so we have to change the way we organise our society to accommodate that, and that we do that in a way which is fair and just, that we, you know, share the finite resources out rather than just concentrating them all in a few people's hands. So part of it is about a kind of mindset, and because I think that's kind of, that's the base of everything else. If you don't win people to green ideas, then you're never going to really get green change. So that always has to be where you start. And then hopefully out of that there'll be a whole bunch of changes about the way we actually do organise our economy and society to make it more sustainable. You know, obviously energy, water, resources, along with fairness are all going to be part of that, in housing, in transport and all the rest of it. And I'm kind of happy to play a role in whatever, you know, whatever opportunity we get, whether, you know, we force the other parties to adopt our policies, because they kind of feel like public pressure has made them, and so, you know, gets implemented that way, or whether we end up in government at some point ourselves and implement them directly, I don't know, and it's not really important. But, yeah, to be part of creating the mindset that makes that happen and then perhaps part of actually implementing it.
In your speech to the Greens conference recently, you talked a lot about water and the need to focus on that. What would you like to see happen with the water policy if you are involved with government next time?
Well, we've been really keen on national policy statement on water, which has some teeth and sets some quite high goals in terms of water being safe for contact recreation, at least as a starting point, and then moving up from there, because currently about two-thirds to three-quarters of all rivers aren't safe for contact recreation or don't meet contact recreation guidelines. And so I think that's the first thing, is to set a standard or a target, and I'm sure the national policy statement that they're going to release shortly won't do that. And then the next thing is a standard that fits into that around water quality, and then starts to move. The regional councils start to move to reach that standard. And obviously key to that's going to be some pretty strict rules around nutrient flows and nutrient flows off land and into waterways. Some pretty strict rules around riparian planting. I think it's going to have to be key to it. The liver of the land. And also about abstraction and limits to abstraction. And we're going to have to challenge, I think, which is going to be really hard, the first come, first served way the RMA works on water allocation, because it's really failing us and it's a real problem, which is going to create an outcry, but has to be done.
What sort of system would you put in place instead? Would you have transferable water rights or tradable water rights, or what would you propose?
I'm ambivalent and again about tradable water rights. I mean, I think there are real problems with tradable water rights. There's practical problems around it, but there's also the danger with them is that you end up privatising it or effectively privatising it. That's why at this stage our policy is a levy, so you create a pricing around it. But obviously going alongside of that is going to have to be a move to time-limited, shortening the time limits of resource consents for water rights. So not only would you have to pay, but you wouldn't necessarily have it forever, because there's a lot of competing demands for water. So, I mean, I think, yeah, those things together. But, yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that you have to do around water. And it's actually, I think, one of the biggest issues we're facing.
Obviously, dairying is a key problem when it comes to water extraction and pollution. What do you see as solutions to the problem with the expansion of dairying in New Zealand at the moment?
Well, dairying's got to work within the ecological limits. It's the first thing that has to be said. What that means for the number of dairy cows, obviously, we'll have to see, but that's got to be the starting point. We need some kind of hold or a moratorium on the thing while we sort it out, because at the moment we've got pretty much uncontrolled expansion. And if you set in place a kind of strict national policy statement and national environmental standards, then I think that you can leave regional councils to sort out catchment by catchment, because it's too complicated for central government to do. But what central government does need to do is actually set some national standards for it. And then where resource consents have already been allocated, which mean that those standards aren't met, well then, you know, regional councils need to look again at them, and look at whether they're sustainable. And I don't think you can do that from central government. I don't think that's the best place to do it.
Moving on to politics at the moment, well, in the last week or so, in the emissions trading scheme, where do the Greens see the emission trading scheme as proposed by the government at this point in time? It's been reported back by the Select Committee. What do you see are the pros and the cons of it at this point in time?
At this point in time, there's probably two pros. One is the framework itself. Just having a framework which content could be put into is positive. And the framework is linked into the international system, which I think is a positive, that, you know, we want to link up these things into the international Kyoto system.
So is that something that is going to be internationally linked up into the Kyoto system and the developing systems around the world?
Yeah.
For trading?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, it's all the units used are Kyoto compliant, even though they're NZUs. It is a bit silly, but anyway, but they are linked up to the international one.
One of the criticisms of that system is that it's basically a way of the rich world trying to pay their way out of having to cut back on pollution while trying to get the poor world to take the money to stay undeveloped. What would you say to that?
It depends. I mean, under Kyoto currently, the developing world doesn't have any targets, even though it's part of Kyoto, it doesn't have targets to reduce its emissions. And secondly, the payments that are transferred from the rich world to the developing world are through CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism. It's a bit unclear how good CDM is, but from a development point of view, I don't think CDM is a negative. From an environmental point of view, it's less clear whether it's a positive. So as things stand, I don't think you're looking at the current Kyoto system doesn't act as an impediment to development in developing countries. But it's entirely possible that in the future you could see it operating like that. It just depends how it evolves. So I think it's a real risk. But it's also true that you do need a global system. There's got to be some kind of global system. And I think the danger of the way that we're connecting into the global system at the moment is that we could simply not reduce our emissions and then buy basically worthless carbon credits from overseas. So we're very keen that all the East European and Russian hot air, you can't buy that to offset your emissions in New Zealand, because that would be pretty pointless. Because as I'm sure you know, there's a lot of carbon credits available from Eastern Europe after the collapse of communism in 89, because their industries collapsed. So because 99 is the base year. The other positive is that that it will have positive effects on forestry in terms of creating some incentives for forestry. The negatives are just the lack of content of the thing aside from forestry, is that just the bringing in of all the other sectors is extremely delayed and uncertain, and so there may not be much positive at all in it if the different sectors aren't brought in. And obviously the other negative, is that we've got put into the purpose clause of the bill that it's actually meant to reduce emissions in New Zealand, because it didn't even have that before. And the danger is that it won't reduce emissions in New Zealand very much at all.
Well, that seems to be the whole problem with it, really, is that the overall goal should be actually, a carbon neutral economy, but that actually means a dramatic reduction year on year between now and 2050 or whenever they want to do it by, to actually have less greenhouse gas emissions. I can't see how this scheme as it's currently proposed will do that in any way, because there's handouts going left, right and centre, and incentives and subsidies, and for whoever who basically puts their hand up and complains, the government tries to pacify them with one thing or another. And at the end of the day, will it actually get us anywhere close to meeting our Kyoto commitments, let alone a carbon neutral status?
We're not going to get anywhere near our Kyoto commitment. I think we're going to be 30% over, probably in 2012. I think that what you said is true. The only question is, it sets up a framework which in the long run could be effective. So say we get to 2012, we're 30% over 1990 levels. Kyoto 2, or whatever it's called, the second commitment period has a target of 20% under 1990 levels, which I think is entirely possible, but we don't know. New Zealand's basically facing a cliff of a 50% reduction over maybe 8 years. I think the effect is, if the different sectors are brought within it, then there will be genuine price signals, because the cost of credits will go up, and that will drive the economy towards a lower carbon system. But that relies on the political will of future governments of actually bringing in all those sectors, and those sectors have shown they've got tremendous political leverage to keep themselves out and let the taxpayer pay for it all, which is the current plan. Under the current period, agriculture is half of all our emissions, and the taxpayer has to pay for all those credits.
Yes, no, it's a bit of a roundabout there. So will the Green Party be supporting the emission trading scheme as it stands?
Not as it's been reported back from the Select Committee. We're still in negotiations to get it changed through a further amendment, and it depends on the outcome of those negotiations.
When are they likely to conclude?
Next 2-3 weeks, probably. Who knows? I think it'll drag on.
Right, so the government's looking to wrap it up before the election then?
Yeah, they want to get it in place before the election so they can say, look what we've done.